From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Tomorrow morning, after a 20-year voyage of discovery, the spacecraft Cassini will plunge to its destruction in the atmosphere of the ringed planet Saturn. Cassini has traveled nearly 5 billion miles on its trip to Saturn, and its years of exploration of Saturn's rings and moons, sending back incredible findings of oceans and geysers, and maybe the building blocks of life out there. This hour on Point, what the Cassini spacecraft has shown us on her long voyage comes to an end. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you dreamt of traveling the path of Cassini through the rings of Saturn? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. NASA's Cassini spacecraft launched from Cape Canaveral, Florida, on October 15th, 1997. Here's the sound from Mission Control during that liftoff.
3, 2, 1. And liftoff of the Cassini spacecraft on a billion-mile trek to Saturn. Pitch program is in. Roll program is in. We have cleared the tower, and the Cassini spacecraft is on its way to Saturn.
That was October 1997, a long, long trip and lots of exploration, years of exploration around Saturn once the spacecraft finally arrived. And now, well, NASA's calling the plunge to its destruction tomorrow, the grand finale. Here's a little bit of a NASA-produced video describing how the Cassini spacecraft will end its long mission tomorrow morning by burning up as it enters Saturn's atmosphere.
After 20 years in space, NASA's Cassini spacecraft is running out of fuel. And so, to protect moons of Saturn that could have conditions suitable for life, a spectacular end has been planned for this long-lived traveler from Earth.
We're going to hear all about it. Later in this hour, we'll talk about Jim Bridenstine, the White House's new pick to head NASA, why he's got his critics as well as his fans. But first, Cassini, its last hours and its legacy. Joining me first from Newark, New Jersey, is our friend Tarek Malik, managing editor of Space.com. Tarek, welcome back to On Point.
Hello, Tom.
It's great to have you here. What is going to happen and when for this to literally end, for the whole thing to vaporize?
So after almost 20 years, on Friday, September 15th at 7:55 a.m. Eastern, that's kind of like the big finale for Cassini. It's going to send its last signal. They're going to lose contact with the spacecraft as it plummets into Saturn at something like 69,000 miles an hour. It will burn up in just a few minutes, they expect, a fiery end to what has been a spectacular mission.
We heard NASA saying there that they're bringing it to an end this way to protect moons of Saturn that could have conditions suitable for life. Why is Cassini's, complete crisping here necessary to protect potential life on the moons?
Well, so Cassini has, it has a prolific mission of discovery around Saturn. And one of the key findings it's found has been these geysers from the icy moon of Enceladus, as well as these lakes on another moon, Saturn's biggest moon, Titan, of liquid methane. And both of those moons are interesting because they have Enceladus has water and heat, two essential ingredients for life on Earth. So that's one check mark. And on Titan, it has a thick atmosphere. It has some sort of liquid ecosystem in place, a lot of building blocks for what we think of life on Earth. And they want to safeguard any kind of contamination if there is the chance, even the slightest chance, of some sort of microbes or whatnot on those moons. They want to make sure that over time, if they just left Cassini in orbit, it wouldn't impact one of those moons and kind of ruin what's there.
You wouldn't think that a spacecraft big as it, I mean, the size of a small school bus, I'm reading here, Cassini, but you wouldn't think that that would represent a threat, but it's plutonium-powered, and I guess that may be one of the primary things they're thinking about here, potential nuclear radiation contamination.
Exactly. So it one of the key parts of Cassini's long life is the fact that it uses this this plutonium power source to kind of keep its systems running over the last 19 and several months on years. Just a safeguard. They're pretty sure it wouldn't pose a threat, but just to be sure, they want to make sure that they burn it up in Saturn, nice and clean, and safeguard those moons.
Tarek, in just a couple of minutes, we're going to hear from a couple of women right in the heart of the Cassini mission. But step back a second. We'll look at all, and talk about all the things that have been discovered here. But among space missions, how does Cassini rank in terms of its success, in terms of the load of insight that it's delivered to humans on planet Earth?
Well, you know, Tom, when Cassini launched in 97, it was still 7 years away from arriving at Saturn. And I remember when it did enter orbit in 2004, there was a lot of hope. It had already taken many, many photos from afar of Saturn. It flew by Jupiter. It flew by Earth and Venus twice just to slingshot its way out there. And so the hope was that they were going to get these close-up views of the rings, you know what how those structures are formed, what Saturn's weather is like, and maybe some key insights into the moons, you know, the biggest moons itself. You know, in the last nearly 20 years, they have found just phenomenal things. 13 years at Saturn, phenomenal things. They found strange hexagon patterns on top of Saturn's poles from these weird storms. They found, I mentioned the plumes, water plumes on a moon around another planet in our solar system, giant geysers shooting out from that moon, weird hidden heat sources on that moon, and Titan. Saturn, you know, Titan was a big entry because it has an atmosphere. Cassini ferried a European probe, Huygens, to land on Titan, the first landing on another moon beyond our own, and you know they found just signs of these liquid lakes, seas on Titan, just amazing things just from the 13 years of watching Saturn flying by, 162 moon flybys, nearly 300 orbits around Saturn. It's just been amazing what they found there.
Tariq Malik at space.com, please stand by there in Newark, New Jersey. I want to go right now as well to Pasadena, California, and the Jet Propulsion Lab there in Pasadena to two women who have been working right in the thick of everything Cassini. Trina Ray joins us. She's an astronomer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab there, deputy manager of the Science Planning and Sequencing Team with the Cassini-Huygens mission to Saturn. Trina Ray, thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, you're quite welcome, Tom.
And Kimberly Stedman joins us from Pasadena as well, system engineer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab. She joined the Cassini team in December 2000. These missions last a long time, has served as mission planner, science planning engineer, flight system engineer. Kim Stedman, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Kim, can you describe exactly what will happen in the next almost, tomorrow morning when this thing turns into Saturn's atmosphere? How far out from the planet has it been? At what point does it turn toward the planet itself? At what point does it begin to destruct? And then when is it gone?
Well, it's going to be gone very quickly once we enter the atmosphere. So we're doing a five-minute roll at 1:37 tomorrow morning to point our ion and mass instrument, our ion and neutral mass spectrometer, into the right configuration so that we can actually taste Saturn's atmosphere as we go in. And then atmospheric reentry will begin with our thrusters firing at 10% capacity at about 4:54, and this is all Pacific Daylight Time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then once we enter the atmosphere, things are going to happen pretty quick for our spacecraft. So just a minute later, our thrusters will be at 100% capacity, and then soon after that, the spacecraft will start to tumble, and within a minute of that, then she will probably melt.
When you say thrusters at 100%, do you mean thrusting the spacecraft toward the planet?
No, just trying to hold the spacecraft so that the main dish, the high-gain antenna, is pointed to Earth so we can get data from the spacecraft. And so our thrusters, our reaction control thrusters, are trying to keep the spacecraft pointed to Earth and keep our instruments pointing to where they're happy so they can get really great science data. And so
until the very last nanosecond, it will be transmitting just as long as it can. What's the atmosphere of Saturn like, Kim Stedman?
Well, that's a good question. I think we'll have to go to Trina Ray for what the atmosphere is like, because I'm the engineer on this.
Okay, Kim's going to point it into that atmosphere. What's it going to hit when it arrives there, when it hits it?
So Saturn is a gas giant. It's mostly made out of hydrogen and helium, but there's other constituents in the atmosphere, water, ammonia, carbon dioxide. And then as you sink into Saturn, all of those things get more dense and more hot. And we think maybe perhaps at the center of Saturn there's a rocky core. But actually investigating the insides of Saturn is one of the top goals of these last 22 orbits in the mission. So we'll have more to say on that once we've analyzed all the data we've collected over the last few months.
So I don't know whether to put it to you or Kim, but what happens to the spacecraft? You know, how does it actually break apart? Does it melt? What happens to the plutonium? What happens here?
Well, she will melt because it's so hot, and then she'll also break apart, and the plutonium and the RTGs that provide her power will probably be the last thing to go, but they will sink a little deeper into Saturn, but they will still melt eventually and get dispersed and amongst Saturn. And Saturn's so huge, she won't even notice it.
And like that, it's gone. And the plutonium and its radioactive effects, is that so dispersed that there's no residual effect, Trina?
We don't expect there to be any visible sign that Cassini has entered Saturn, although we will have telescopes here on the Earth looking to see if there's a flash of light, maybe from the spacecraft melting. But we don't really expect to see anything here at the Earth.
Kind of incredible. Is this, I don't know how you feel about it, Kim, at the end of a long mission like this, and you've been on it since 2000, is it emotional? Is it just scientific? Is it both?
I think it's both. It's emotional for everybody that's worked on Cassini for really any amount of time because it's such a great spacecraft, and she's done everything we've asked of her. I mean, she's gone above and beyond. Her original prime mission was 4 years. She's been there 13 years, and she's done everything, like I said, that we've asked of her. And so you're very proud. This is a great ending because the science we're getting from this final plunge is the only way we could have gotten the science. It's science no one ever expected to get. So you're proud, but you're a little sad because you've been with her for so long.
We are delighted to have two of the folks at NASA who have been in the thick of the Cassini mission with us today, Kimberly Stedman and Trina Ray from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, NASA's in Pasadena, California. Tarek Malik is with us from space.com. He's managing editor there and all over this as well. We're looking at the Cassini spacecraft early tomorrow, ending its 20-year voyage. We're going to look at all that it has seen and sent back to Earth, discovered. Here's the London Symphony Orchestra with Holst the Planet's Saturn.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Cassini spacecraft early tomorrow, ending its 20-year voyage and its deep exploration of Saturn, its rings, its moons. Kimberly Stedman has worked on this project for a long time. She's a system engineer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, and joins us today. Trina Ray is there at the Jet Propulsion Lab as well, astronomer at the lab for NASA. And deputy manager of the science and planning and sequencing team with the Cassini-Huygens mission to Saturn. The latter, and this was a U.S.-European joint project. The Europeans did the landing craft that came down on Titan, the biggest moon of Saturn, and we'll talk about that as well. Your questions are very welcome as Cassini heads toward, very soon now, its fiery end in the atmosphere of Saturn. Tarek Malik is with us as well, managing editor at space.com, and just in the thick of all of this. We want to look at the findings over the years that Cassini brought to us. But Kim Stedman, would you tell us first just about, this is a long way to Saturn, and what were the most critical moments in just getting the spacecraft into the right position to do the work that it's done?
Oh, yes. First of all, the scariest moment for everybody in the mission is launch, because there's a spacecraft you worked years to build, excuse me, and it's up on top of a launch vehicle with all this propellant, and things don't go well,
mm-hmm.
Well, then your mission's over instantly. But then we actually toured the inner solar system, going by Venus twice and Earth again, so that we could build up enough speed to fling ourselves out to Saturn. And then we did Jupiter flyby, but then the next biggest moment was the Saturn orbit insertion burn, where we had to burn our main engine for almost 96 minutes to slow us down enough so that Saturn would capture us into orbit. And that was a very exciting time, because if it didn't go well, we could just be a flyby.
What was at stake in that 96-minute burn? You're burning the thrusters to what? Slow it down, get it into the right position? How would it be a flyby?
Right. You have to slow yourself down enough that you don't just go flying by Saturn. You want to slow the spacecraft down enough so that Saturn can capture Cassini into orbit. And so if our engine had not burned long enough, then there was a chance that we could just go right by.
What year was that?
Gosh, that was 2004.
2004. So none of this discovery would have really been possible unless you caught that window just right. And I guess you did. You snagged it into Saturn's orbit, and there it stayed.
Yeah, everything went perfect with our Saturn orbit insertion burn. It was a very exciting time here at the lab, and that's when we really could get to work.
Trina Ray, take us into the discoveries of this spacecraft, and I don't know how to rank order them, but you tell us, either in chronologically or in terms of significance, what has been most important about what Cassini has found?
So I would say, in no particular order, because you're right,
okay,
it's very hard to rank them.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing is that we had this tremendous international partnership with the Europeans, who had the Huygens probe, and the Huygens landed on Titan. And unveiling Titan's surface was just gigantic. This is one of the most Earth-like bodies in the solar system. It has, you know, methane clouds and rain and seas and dunes and rivers. And it just is incredibly Earth-like. So understanding Titan's surface and all of the complexities of Titan is surely one of our top results. The little moon Enceladus, it's about the size of Iowa, has an ocean underneath, an icy shell, and there are cracks at the South Pole, and that ocean is being spit out into space, and there are huge geysers, water geysers, that spit out into space. Just like at Yellowstone, there's a heat mm-hmm. source underneath, and you have a water geyser on Enceladus, there's a heat source underneath, and you have these giant geysers that are spitting this ocean out into space, creating this beautiful ring around Saturn, the E-ring. And then I guess the third thing I would say is the rings of Saturn have a tremendous diversity of processes and so much complexity that we've learned about in the last 13 years, just an incredible array of things that we've learned about. And finally, of course, the planet itself. We watched a once every 30-year storm come along, and we just happened to be there because of our extended mission. That storm lasted for about a year. It encircled the whole planet. A fantastic set of observations. And really, that only scratches the surface, Tom. We've had 4,000 peer-reviewed scientific publications from Cassini, and that is just, that's an incredible number. And that is sure to grow. Now that the mission is over in terms of its operations, the scientists can really refocus their time and attention on analyzing and squeezing every bit of data and every publication and every bit of learning that they can out of this data set.
Kim Stedman, are Saturn's famous rings, were they dangerous to Cassini? Can you get knocked around there, or is it not like that?
Well, we stayed away from the rings because flying through the rings themselves would have been very bad for us.
Are there rocks in there, or is that crystals, or what are they made of?
Well, I think it's mostly ice, and there's some rocks in there. So what we did was to study the rings, we flew above the rings, and we did a high inclination orbit so that we could look down upon the rings. But when we were at equinox, we wanted to be sort of more in the ring plane so that we could see the shadows that were made from the larger items in the rings across the rest of the rings, so we could see what was in there.
Trina, maybe you already knew, but why does Saturn have rings at all? What's the origin?
So we're not exactly sure why Saturn has rings. All four of the giant planets do have ring systems, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. But Saturn's rings are clearly in a class by themselves. They're spectacular. And we don't know if a small moon broke up or maybe a comet, but we do know that the rings, you know, basically what they're made out of, we know that they're very, you know, sort of conservation of angular momentum has caused all the debris to flatten out. They're very flat. They're sort of the ratio of a piece of paper, right, around Saturn. But they're very
I read there are only something like, is it possible, 30
30 meters thick or something, those rings?
Yes. And in fact, Kim was talking about at equinox, where we had the sun coming in right at the edge, so just exactly perfectly at the edge of the rings. So anything that was a little bit up or a little bit down, yeah, you would cast these huge shadows. And so we could see that there were a few things in the rings that would go up 100 meters, maybe 400 meters. There's a few bending waves that go up a kilometer or so, but most of the rings are quite flat. 30 meters is a fine number.
Tariq Malik, you've been watching all this and watching the results come out for years as NASA people like Trina and Kim have been making all this happen. For, you know, space journalists who are really focused on this, what most turned your head about the Cassini findings?
Well, you know, Saturn is like a mini solar system. It's got rings like our asteroid belt. It has moons like the other planets. And so it's like this microcosm of everything cool you could think of around a planet. The photos, you know, in particular have been amazing. And Saturn, Cassini has kind of grown up through the evolution of digital media to bring a mission like this home to the public in ways that in the past, you know, the Voyager probes and whatnot had never had an opportunity to. NASA and Cassini have been able to share spectacular images of Mimas, a moon around Saturn that looks just like the Death Star from Star Wars, and clouds over Titan directly to people in a way that really galvanizes interest or just gets people really cheering for a mission like this in ways that maybe the older missions didn't. But these spectacular views of the rings, the strange hexagon storm, it blows me away every time I see a new photo of these polar storms at the top of Saturn. It's just amazing what this mission has been able to do and how it's tracked the changes on Saturn over time, over the 13 years that it's been in orbit around this ring planet.
Trina, what's the meaning or origin of a hexagon storm? What does that even mean?
So the hexagon storm is pretty much exactly as you would imagine from its name. It's a hexagon-shaped feature at the north pole of the planet of Saturn. It's really a jet stream. So here on Earth, we know what jet streams are, and we're familiar with them. It's sort of a high-velocity part of the atmospheric of the atmosphere. And remember, Saturn is a giant gas planet, so it's basically, you know, a swirling, you know, swirling gas. So nothing is moving exactly at the same speed. Things are moving a little bit faster at the equator, a little bit slower at the poles. But there's this one spot where it's moving quite high. It's a high-velocity jet stream. And it just so happens that there's a standing wave there that has six sides, a hexagon. Now, we don't know why it's six sides. It could have been an octagon. It could have been something else. So the fact that it is six sides is telling us something important about Saturn's atmosphere that we just don't understand yet. But basically, it's just a jet stream.
More to learn. Al in Baltimore, Maryland. Thank you for calling, Al. You're on the air with Trina, Kim, and Tariq.
Hi, Tom. I just had a question. I know one of the concerns was about contamination from Earth with landing probes. So how are we sure that the probe that was set down on Titan didn't bring contamination with it?
So the Huygens probe went through a planetary protection process that it was cleaned to a particular level. But then remember, it was also going very, very fast when it got to Titan. And it had a heat shield on the front. And the heat shield was there to slow the spacecraft down, but it got very, very hot. And one of the two ways that we clean spacecraft here on the Earth when they go into a clean room is we either swab them down with alcohol or similar disinfectant, or we bake them. And so basically when Huygens went into the atmosphere, it got quite hot. Now, probably still some microbes survived. There's almost nothing you can do to guarantee 100% that there's nothing on the spacecraft. But we did everything we could and everything that made sense to do at the time. There's always a balance about how much effort you spend for planetary protection and what you want to get out of it.
Kim, the plutonium contamination was the big fear when it came to Cassini, but did Huygens have any nuclear material?
No, Huygens just had a battery. She didn't have any nuclear material on board.
And is the landing craft still sitting on Titan?
Yep. Until we go and get it, that's where it'll be.
Is there any more broadcasting from it? Is it sending any signals, or that's over?
No, it just lasted a few hours. Because it sent all its signal to Cassini, and Cassini's screaming by at a very high speed.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just was a few hours, as long as the battery lasted. It lasted actually longer than we thought it would.
The landing craft was the European contribution to this. Are they sharing in all the data that's come out of both Cassini and Huygens?
Yes, and also some of our instruments have been built by our European partners. So Cassini is truly a European-American collaboration.
Trina, what's the size of Titan compared to, let's say, Earth's moon?
So the size of Titan, I actually like to compare it to the United States. It's about the size of the United States.
What do you mean by that? The circumference?
So sort of New York, Los Angeles, put a giant globe, New York,
okay,
Los
okay,
Angeles.
Okay, okay, yeah. So it's big.
Oh, it's quite big. It is the second largest moon in the solar system. Only Ganymede, the moon of Jupiter, is larger, and only by a hair. In fact, 100 years ago, Titan and Ganymede were tied. We didn't know which one was bigger. It's actually larger than the planet Mercury, and so it's quite a world in its own right.
Elias is calling from Portland, Maine. Elias, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you, Tom. Thank you, folks. I have followed the Cassini mission closely as an amateur from when it first began. And
yeah.
Some of the things like the Titan information and the cyclones, the hexagon cyclones, all that has been really fascinating. But what I find the most interesting are the features that it showed us on the moon of Iapetus. And I was wondering, there were three specific features that I haven't heard anything about since they were first shot, and I was wondering what we've learned about them since. One, there's a gigantic, wall or mountain-like formation that goes around the entire equator of Iapetus, and it's 12 miles high and I think 100 miles wide. And the images of it are amazing, and I was wondering if we'd learned about how that got formed. And the next, I was wondering if we figured out why Iapetus is exactly half black and half white. And the third feature that I was curious about is that the erosion on Iapetus seems to happen in giant hexagon plate shapes. If you look at them, they're a giant hexagon. And when you zoom in on it, you see that's filled with smaller, but yet still giant hexagons. And they're all eroding in these hexagon shapes down smaller and smaller. And I was wondering if we figured out why that's happening and what the mechanisms behind those features are.
Elias, we will take it straight to NASA for you from Maine. Trina Ray, we've got a hexagon theme here, but start if you would with is there a wall of the equator here? Would Donald Trump like this moon?
So actually, I love Iapetus. Thanks, Elias. Iapetus is one of the most interesting moons in the Saturn family. And yes, it is sort of half black and half white. It's colored like a baseball. So think of the top and the front and the bottom as being blacker than tar, and the sides and the back are sort of white as snow. And one of the interesting things, as Elias mentioned, is that we've known this for quite some time. For 300 years, we've known about this very dramatic albedo difference between the two sides. And what we didn't know was this imposed from the outside, or does this come from Iapetus itself? So Elias, I can tell you one answer. We know the answer now is that it is imposed from the outside. A little bit of dust landed on Iapetus. I'm pretty sure it's Phoebe dust, but I'd have to check. And then over time, as Iapetus got hot and cold and hot and cold, it actually created that pattern that you see of where all the snow collects on the back and the sides, and it leaves darker things on the top and bottom and front. So the color difference is there, and we think we have a good handle on it. When we did our very first flyby, we were stunned by this equatorial ridge that is as described. It's gigantic. It goes all the way around the equator. We think that comes from how Iapetus cooled down. We think there was a time when it was still a little bit warm inside, but cooling quickly, and it kind of crumpled right at the middle as it cooled. That is our best explanation that we have to date. And sadly, I'm not familiar with the hexagon shapes on the surface. I'll have to take a look at that some other time, and you'll have to catch me on some other interview for that answer.
Tarek, I'm reading here that the strangeness of Iapetus inspired Arthur C. Clarke to hide that alien monument on its dark side in 2001, A Space Odyssey here. That would have just been a mystery when Arthur C. Clarke wrote 2001. Cassini helped us understand what's going on there, Tarek.
That's right. You know, there Saturn was a complete mystery. You know, back when 2001 was written, it was a complete mystery almost in terms of up close details. You know, just 13 years ago, before Cassini got there. You know, Iapetus is a wonderful example. It's a strange walnut moon. There's another moon, I think it's Janus, that looks like a ravioli. There's all these things that we're finding about Saturn that have either answered some mysteries, like the formation of Iapetus, or have sparked others, like the weird jet stream, or exactly how long is a day on Saturn. That was a key mystery that I know that they've pinned it down closely, but that exact timing still is elusive there.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Cassini spacecraft, early tomorrow, ending its 20-year voyage and its deep exploration of Saturn, its rings, its moons. We have Kimberly Studman and Trina Ray with us from the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. System engineer at the lab there, Kim Studman. Trina Ray, astronomer at the lab. They are deeply enmeshed in the work of Cassini. That long, long journey ending tomorrow as it burns up in the atmosphere of Saturn. Tarek Malik is with us, managing editor of Space.com from Newark, New Jersey today. You can join us this hour. What's your question on what we have learned from Cassini? We will talk before this hour is over about Donald Trump's nominee to be the next head of NASA. But Cassini first. Actor Robert Picardo played the Doctor on Star Trek Voyager. He's also a member of the board of directors of the Planetary Society. He put out a short tongue-in-cheek opera in the last few days celebrating the Cassini mission.
You showed us Saturn's rings and lots of pretty things. Huygens probe took a dive early 2005. Landed on Titan. It was exciting. Your mission never fail to surprise.
Okay, we won't be music critics, but he's having good fun with Cassini there, and we love it. Joe in Boston, thank you for calling, Joe. You're on the air.
I'm just curious. New York Times had mentioned that one of the planets had geysers of water coming out of it. That was one of the shots Cassini got. I'm curious, for light constraints, what keeps going there and seeing if there's any life?
Question, what keeps us from going there to see if there's any life? Can we just pick up the life question overall? The geysers are Enceladus. Let's start with Titan, because it's also, and then we'll come to it, Joe, I promise, to your question. But, Trina, I've seen Titan described as one of the top spots to search for alien life in our solar system. Mm-hmm. Really? And why?
So Titan is a very Earth-like body, and very importantly, it has a cycle. On the Earth, there's the hydrological cycle with water. The Earth's temperature is very close to the triple point of water, so that means frozen, liquid, and gaseous water vapor is available in the system. Same thing is true on Titan, but it's so cold out there, it's not the water that does that. It's methane and ethane. So the water is frozen solid. The mountains are made out of water. When you walk around, you walk on bedrock of water. But the methane and ethane, we have methane and ethane clouds, and then we have methane rain that falls into rivers, and we have lakes and seas. And so we have this very complex interaction between the atmosphere and the surface, and we have standing liquid on the surface. And so these are all things that are very interesting to the astrobiological community.
Are they promising in terms of the potential support of life?
They are promising, but we did not take the instruments to discover that because we didn't know what we were going to see. The same thing with Cassini. We didn't know about the geysers, so we didn't build instruments to really get into and understand about life in the geysers, if there is any evidence of life in the geysers. So that's left for another mission.
There you're talking about the geysers on Enceladus. Describe those geysers, how they are, what they are, how they work, and if there's life on Enceladus, where theories speculate or hypotheses it might be?
So Enceladus is also very interesting to the astrobiological community because what we have on Enceladus is we have, even though it is a small moon, we have an ocean underneath, a global ocean. And we know that Enceladus is getting tugged by other moons in the Saturn system and generating some heat, some tidal forces. And because the ice shell and the inner rocky core are separated by an ocean, you can really flex the ice shell quite a lot and create a lot of heat. It was a mystery when we first got there and we saw these geysers, what was the heat source, but now we have a better handle on it. But there's a crack, a series of cracks at the south pole of Enceladus, and that ocean can shoot out of those cracks and into space. And we have flown through the geysers with all the instruments that we took, our ion and neutral mass spectrometer, found water vapor and methane, in fact, a little too much methane for, you know, sort of the models that we mm-hmm. had going into it. And then our dust detector detected tiny little nanograins of silicate, and it also detected salt. And all of that put together tells us that there is a liquid ocean made of water that is touching a hot, rocky core that is getting super saturated with silicates, and then that hot ocean is getting shot out of the geysers, cooling off very quickly. That's what makes the little nanograins and making the E-ring, but we still have the salty water crystals that the dust detector can pick up. So it's very interesting astrobiologically. And the final piece of interest was, would there be hydrogen in the plume? Because if there's hydrogen, that isn't something that would happen from a normal chemical process in abundance. But if it does, we have to understand it. But the interesting thing about hydrogen is it is the food for microbes. So now you have a hot ocean thermal vent, mm-hmm. and you have food for microbes. Of course, we are now interested in Enceladus as a potential place where we might discover life in the solar system.
Here's a real novice's question, but sure. Here we're talking about the silicates and salts and hydrogen and food for microbes. If there were life there, would it be life that we could recognize, Trina?
Well, so we don't know. We have to go check it out. We have to go explore and learn. I would hope that we would learn something in the next mission. I hope the next mission comes in my lifetime to Enceladus. But that's a question for the next mission.
Kim, our caller Joe wants to know, you know, what's keeping us from going in there? I don't know, even going into the oceans of Enceladus. What would it take to go back and really focus on the potential or reality of life there, Kim?
Well, it would be a real technological challenge because we expect if there is life that it's in the ocean, so we would have to get through the ice. And so NASA actually has a mission going that's being built that's going to Europa, which is also an icy moon that has an interior ocean. And so we hope to learn some stuff from that, how they're going to do that, and hopefully we'll get back to Enceladus and Titan, too.
But that's, of course, that's a moon of Jupiter. I mean, can you imagine this, having the power to bore through the ice of Enceladus one day and look at that lake inside? Or is that just beyond what could be done?
No, I think it can be done, absolutely. We just have to learn more about it before we try and drill through the ice, how thick it is, where's the best place to land, and, you know, do some work and see how much, if we can go down through the cracks, what do we want to send down there? Do we want to send just a probe, or do you want to send, you know, a vehicle that can actually move around in the water?
So, Tarek, what are the odds of the Earthlings sending another probe to Saturn in Trina's lifetime? And let's assume it's a wonderful long lifetime.
Well, you know, that is a really interesting thing. There are studies right now that NASA is evaluating a series of future missions. And on that list, and it has a, you know, lots of high-tech ones, there are missions for Enceladus, for Titan being considered, you know, that would look at those moons up close. So those are, you know, a longer lead time, maybe the next like 10, 15 years out. But, you know, if those make the cut, that could be the next big stop for us.
Well, we are really grateful to all three of you. I mean, first, Trina Ray and Kimberly Stedman for your work on this project. Hey, let's put up some more. We'll have Cassini on our mind as it goes into the atmosphere tomorrow. Kim Stedman, I know you'll be watching that very closely. System engineer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Thank you very much for being with us today, Kim.
Thank you for having me.
And Trina Ray, astronomer at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory there. It's just been utterly fascinating to hear some of these results. Thank you, Trina, for your work, and thanks for your time today.
Okay. You're welcome.
In a moment, the new pick of the White House for NASA administrator. This is On Point. Congressman Jim Bridenstine, Republican of Oklahoma, is the White House's nominee to be the next head of NASA. No date yet for confirmation hearings, but he might get a run for his money when that time comes. Joining me now from Washington to tell us about NASA's possible next chief is Jeff Faust, senior staff writer at Space News. Jeff, welcome back to On Point.
Hello, Tom. It's great to be on.
Okay, so who's retiring and what's the significance of this change? Or is it a retirement?
Well, the previous administrator, Charles Bolden, stepped down at the end of the Obama administration in January. And so NASA has been led since January 20th by an acting administrator named Robert Lightfoot, who is the third in command of the agency under normal situation. And we've been waiting for many months for the new administration to nominate someone to lead NASA. And just before Labor Day weekend, we finally got that in Jim Bridenstine.
Introduce us to Congressman Jim Bridenstine.
Jim Bridenstine is, as you mentioned, a Republican from Oklahoma. His district includes the city of Tulsa. He is in his third term in Congress. He was a U.S. Navy pilot. He led for a time the Tulsa Air and Space Museum there before running for Congress. He's been very active in space policy issues during his time in Congress. He served on the House Science Committee, which oversees NASA, as well as the House Armed Services Committee that overlooks military space issues as well. So he's been very active on the space policy side, but he is not a scientist, nor is he an engineer.
We've seen a pattern of the Trump administration putting non-scientists up into positions that were very important to science, sometimes even people who look like they were anti-science. What's Bridenstine's profile on that front?
Well, he is not a scientist. He is, again, a politician. He is not, though, I would say, anti-science. A lot of people point out some comments that he has made in the past that appeared to be skeptical about global warming and humanity's role in that. I think he's stepped away from those positions more recently. He certainly has been a supporter of the agency in general, including its science programs, and would like to see the agency do even more.
I mean, here's a little bit of that. This has got a lot of attention. This is back in 2013, and this was Representative Jim Bridenstine talking on the House floor. This is June of 2013, remarks that appeared to deny man-made climate change.
During the medieval warm period from 800 to 1300 AD, long before cars, power plants, or the Industrial Revolution, temperatures were warmer than today. During the Little Ice Age from 1300 to 1900 AD, temperatures were cooler. Neither of these periods were caused by any human activity.
Jeff Faust at Space News, you say he's stepped back from some of that. Is that he's stepped back since his name has been put up for NASA or before?
Before that, he did an interview with his local newspaper in Tulsa a while back and acknowledged that, yes, carbon dioxide does play a role in climate change, and humans are producing carbon dioxide, and that's having a role in changing the climate. There may be some disagreements on how strong humanity's role in the changing climate is compared to what scientists, by and large, believe, but he is not the anti-science skeptic that clip alone would appear to make him sound to be.
How does his background compare with those who have previously led NASA? Is he within the sort of frame of tradition here or not?
You know, there's been a real mix of people who have led NASA over the years. Charles Bolden, the previous administrator, was a former astronaut who flew on four space shuttle missions. The administrator before that, Michael Griffin, was a talented engineer and manager, very experienced in the space industry. But the person even before that, Sean O'Keefe, who was administrator during part of the George W. Bush administration, had no space experience. when he took over the agency. He was at the Office of Management and Budget, and he was brought in to really help bring some cost control to NASA programs like the International Space Station, and was very successful in that, but he did not have a space background. And one of the most lauded administrators in NASA's history was James Webb, who was selected by JFK in 1961 to lead the agency and led it through much of the Apollo program, had no space background at all. Mm-hmm. He had worked at the some government agencies. He had worked for an oil company, had not worked in space. But is such a was such a talented leader that NASA has actually named its next major space telescope, the successor to the Hubble Space Telescope, the James Webb Space Telescope.
There has
there's been a wide range of people who have led the agency, and Jim Bridenstine is certainly not an outlier in that respect.
There has been some opposition to his nomination. From whom and why?
Well, there have been some guarded comments by Florida's two senators, Marco Rubio, a Republican, and Bill Nelson, a Democrat. When the nomination was first announced just before Labor Day, they expressed some concern about having a politician lead the agency. They did not outright oppose the nomination, but they were not endorsing the nomination, and I think, you know, they wanted to hear more from Bridenstine and about his record and what he would do at the agency before getting on board with his nomination.
Jim Bridenstine, as the Washington Post reminds us, would be the first NASA administrator in the post-Apollo era who wasn't born when Neil Armstrong walked on the moon. If he is confirmed into this position, what are the big challenges NASA is facing right now, Jeff? What would he be? What issues would he be leading on or asked to lead on?
Well, one of the big questions is what happens after the International Space Station? It's been a tremendously successful program. It's going to be operating through at least 2024 in partnership with Russia and Europe and Japan and Canada. But the question is, well, what happens after that? NASA has laid out previously plans to send humans to Mars, perhaps at some point in the 2030s, but how you get to Mars from where we are now, you know, the various steps, the various programs to get there from here, remain under discussion and debate. And certainly I think he's going to be expected to help provide some more clarity on what those future programs look like, including what role the moon plays in future human spaceflight. Do we return back to the lunar surface? Do we simply send humans around in orbit around the moon and do long-duration spaceflight there? Or do we skip the moon entirely and go directly to Mars? There are different viewpoints on that, and Bridenstine is actually a very strong supporter of lunar exploration by both governments and the private sector. So I would not be surprised that he would seek to orient NASA a little bit more towards the moon as a stepping stone on the way to Mars.
Because, what, you could have private enterprise more engaged in lunar exploration or settlement?
You could have them working in partnership and hopefully doing more together than they could do separately.
Trump administration supportive of NASA? There's a lot of talk of cutbacks elsewhere. What about NASA, Jeff?
NASA's budget is actually hopefully getting a little bit of an increase right now. As today, the House is voting on an appropriations bill that would give NASA nearly $20 billion, which is about $500 million more than it received in 2017.
Jeff, we're out of time right there. We're very grateful to you for joining us. Jeff Faust, senior staff writer at Space News. Here may come a new NASA administrator. Listeners, thanks for joining us. This is On Point.